Whether you want to travel more or communicate better with international clients, you need to try Babbel. I've used Babbel's courses, and you can do the same in order to learn real-life conversation skills in a different language, order food, ask for directions, or speak to clients without having to use translation apps. Right now, get 60% off your Babbel subscription. This is only for our listeners at babbel.com/freelance. That's 60% off at babbel.com/freelance, spelled BABBEL.com/freelance. Rules and restrictions apply. When you wake up in the morning and check your phone, does it feel like this or like this? Because with Shopify, your morning can feel like this way more often. That's the sound of a sale being made on your new Shopify store. And while client payments may require weeks or months of work, you can start generating a semi-passive income to grow your business by setting up a Shopify store all of your own. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your latest designs on shirts or bags or adding something totally different to your business, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. You can sell online, you can sell in person, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. With Shopify, you can set up your store in minutes and start selling immediately. And Shopify's award-winning support is there to help you as you go. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/freelance. That's all lowercase. That's shopify.com/freelance to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/freelance, or click the link in our show description and start waking up to this.
I'm Brandon Hull, and it's time for Freelance to Founder.
I wasn't worried about optimizing revenue or optimizing profits early on. It was really just a matter of answering that test. Like, are there people who are willing to pull out their credit card? And what does this sort of like growth prospects look for this? Is there product market fit for this type of thing? Like, do people find value in it that they're willing to pay for? You know, 100 people sign up the first month, and then 125 or 150 signed up the second month. So all of a sudden there are 250 people on the list by the end of month two. That point where I started to think like, okay, there is something here. People are valuing it.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me for a new episode of Freelance to Founder. If you're one of our regulars, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that via rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, Apple, Google, or wherever, and by connecting with me on Twitter at Brandon Hull, H-U-L-L. If you're new to the podcast, this is a show where I talk to entrepreneurs of all kinds, marketing agency leaders, online course builders, physical product inventors, software developers, all varieties. And what makes them unique is that in many cases, they started these pursuits as freelance gigs that ultimately took on a whole new life and scaled far beyond the founders' expectations, and definitely bigger than themselves. I'm excited to share this conversation with you today. Over the years, we've had tremendous guests, and well, many of our founders sort of stumbled upon their businesses. They had a talent for doing something specific or experience in an industry, and their business just sort of emerged. Becca Cordes in season 2, Brendan Dunn in season 3, Sarah Morgan in season 4, Courtney Slaznick in season 5. There are actually too many to name. And this week's story fits so well with theirs. Scott Keyes, he was a journalist. He loved the work, in fact. It wasn't due to extreme boredom or hatred of the cubicle life, so to speak, or anything along those lines that caused him to start his aptly named Scott's Cheap Flights. It was an innate ability to find great travel deals that turned into an email list that grew and grew and grew until he almost felt obligated to turn it into a business. 6 years later, there are 22 employees involved. He's got a killer premium membership offering in what I think is a nearly recession-proof business, helping people find cheap flights to destinations around the world. What I like about this episode is how we go beyond what Scott did to grow his business into what he's learned about how it applies to others' businesses. He gets asked for advice all the time, and while he realizes he didn't map out his business in some sophisticated way, he's learned great lessons about building a digital membership product, growing an email list, and staying ahead of the curve when it comes to competition and even internet trends. Importantly, you're going to hear how he discovered a co-founder and went with his gut intuition in bringing Brian Kidwell on board as Chief Operations Officer, and his take in general on risk mitigation in the hiring process. We talk at length about hiring in your earliest days as a founder. It's really good stuff. And you'll finally hear how he made the decision to let Scott's Cheap Flights become his full-time endeavor, how he set aside his other pursuits, his other interests, to make this his thing. And as is our new norm, stick with us to the end. You'll hear Scott's answers to our 3-in-1 questions, one principle, one habit, and one person that are an important part of his journey. All right, that's your setup. Scott was generous with his time, open with his advice, and really insightful with his answers and guidance. I hope you enjoy this special episode of Freelance to Founder. Mr. Scott Keys, thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on Freelance to Founder.
Great to be here.
Your story is a genuine freelance to founder story, because what you're doing today was not at all what the game plan was, I would say, 10 years ago. And so I'm looking forward to not only getting that story, the how-tos and that sort of thing, but for people to have a chance to get to know you personally and how you evaluated that this should be a pivot that you should make. So I'm really looking forward to this. Thanks again.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here, excited to jump into it.
So Scott's Cheap Flights has been around since 2013. And 6 years into this now, I guess the first question I would ask, and it's the first question I ask most of our guests, is what can you tell us about where the business is today in terms of members, social following, and how where it's at versus where you thought it would be when you first started this thing off just a few years back?
Absolutely. So let me start by explaining how Scott's Cheap Flights came to be. Scott's Cheap Flights is not, I was never one of those persons who like was an aspiring entrepreneur, somebody who just really wanted to start a business but didn't know what, you know, somebody who was just like champing at the bit to be in a startup. That was never my background, never my desire or goal. But I was a guy who just really loved to travel and didn't have much money in the bank account. And so trying to kind of square those two things together and being able to travel without much money led me sort of down a rabbit hole where I spent years researching, hey, what are all the things that I can be doing to try to make sure I'm getting the best possible deal on flights whenever I need them? And it all then culminated in 2013 when I came across the best deal that I've ever gotten in my life, still to this day, which was nonstop from New York City to Milan for $130 round trip. Absolutely incredible deal.
Which makes no sense.
No sense at all. That's a flight that ought to cost, that generally costs closer to $1,000, at least certainly at the time. And so, you know, Milan hadn't been somewhere on my radar. It was totally, an indulgent kind of whim, but I was like, yes, you know, for $130, there's nowhere in the world I wouldn't go. So I had a wonderful trip. But what was interesting was when I got back from this trip, all of my friends and coworkers kept coming up to me, hey, Scott, will you let me know next time you find a deal like that so I can get in on it too? And so rather than trying to remember every single person I needed to let know next time I found a good flight deal, I decided, why don't I just start a simple little email list? That way I can let everybody know at once. And so that's how Scott's Cheap Flights got started. It wasn't a business goal or a plan or anything. It was just the simplest solution to be able to let my friends know when I found a good flight deal. And at the time it was making, like, for years, it was not a business. It was just a hobby. It was just something I did for fun. And so I think we can get into kind of how it grew to what it has, but it really surprises a lot of people today that from that sort of very humble origin, it now today is an email list with close to 2 million members on the list and 40 people on the Scott's Cheap Flights team and growing really quickly. And the fact that it has become what it is today, so widespread and just far larger than I ever could have imagined, is a real. I would like to think that it's a like pat on my own back, but I think really it's a testament to people's love for travel and specifically for cheap flights.
Yep, and I think I would absolutely agree with that. In fact, I can't offer a counter to that whatsoever. I think the only thing I would add is that maybe some people's feeling of it's hard to make sure that they're really finding the best possible flight options out there as well, right? Because the preponderance of choice is a little bit difficult for them. So to have one trusted source that they can turn to and over time that they absolutely can verify or count on is a big part of that as well, right?
That's exactly right. You know, there's such a mental tax with booking flights that is not true of buying most things. You know, you go to the grocery store and you're not sitting there like just laboring, spending so much time and energy over like, which milk should I buy? You know, it's not that weighty of a decision, and the price tends to be pretty rational. How much you pay is generally, you know, correlated with how much you buy. And price tends to be pretty consistent. What it cost yesterday is about what it costs today and about what it costs tomorrow. And none of that is true for flights. The price is constantly jumping around. You know, the exact same flight will be $800 yesterday and $300 today and $1,300 tomorrow. And it has oftentimes no correlation to how far you fly. And so I think it really kind of is a stressful thing because people want to be able to travel. They know they need a flight if they want to go overseas. And yet they have, in order to get a flight, they have to engage in buying this thing that which behavior is seemingly like nonsensical. It ends up being a pretty negative experience. And that's what we're trying to kind of help people with and alleviate, to be able to direct them towards the cheap flights so that it ends up being a really positive experience. They can travel more and not have that anxiety hanging over their heads.
Yeah. And I wonder if some people are so worried about missing out on a great deal, but also that there's the reverse fear that they feel like they're going to be taken. And so when your origin story in that way with your ticket to Milan is fascinating to me, because you in some ways stumbled upon an opportunity that shouldn't have existed, right? It's like, it's either a broken algorithm, a broken offer or something like that. And I can see the excitement of turning that into something where other people can take advantage of it as well. The difficulty becomes, in my mind, and we'll get into this obviously throughout this conversation, but the difficulty becomes in repeating that over and over and finding always great opportunities that are ones that they couldn't have found on their own, or at least darn comparable. When you stumbled upon this and people are coming to you like, you find this again, Scott, and you better tell me, because I might be like you and book a flight that I hadn't planned to book to begin with. Did the idea of being able to repeat this in a regular way before you even thought about making into a larger company that employed people, did the idea of duplicating this over and over, was that a fear in your mind? Like, wait, it might have just been fool's gold, a one-time thing that I can't repeat this. How did you sort through that?
It was, you know, that was rewind to 2013. And if I had, you know, sort of envisioned forward, okay, this is going to become larger, what are going to be the stumbling blocks or the hurdles that you need to overcome? That would have been one of the primary things in my mind, thinking, how am I going to find the deals? How are there enough deals that this is something that people, you know, would be interested in, much less be willing to pay for? And whether through serendipity or just sheer luck or skill I've developed, that has not been the case at all. Much to my surprise, I would have expected it'd be very difficult to find deals constantly. But we are so fortunate, all of us, anybody who likes to travel, to be living right now, because we are living right now in the golden age of cheap flights. It has never been cheaper to travel overseas as it is today. And so the fact that even 7 years ago, it would, you know, you'd almost never see flights to Europe under $900 round trip. Like, it was quite rare. Nowadays, regularly see them $300 round trip, sometimes even lower. And so it really, I think, gives a bit of a shock and a jolt to a lot of people who are used to paying two or three times what it costs today to be able to fly overseas. So there are a number of factors that have caused airfare to become much cheaper than it's historically been. And it's just, I think, in some ways, just very sort of lucky and serendipitous timing that Sky Flights started and began during this, downswing in prices. That it started at a time when cheap flights were starting to become very, very plentiful. And because, look, at the end of the day, we can't force airlines to offer a price on a ticket other than what they do. All we can do is be sitting there monitoring and making sure that as soon as prices do drop to a point where we say that this is a really good, worthwhile, valuable flight, you know, when that happens, then we can let our members know about it. But we can't like force the airlines to offer these $300 flights to Europe. We're just lucky that we're living in a time right now when they do regularly as well.
Right. And you have, you've obviously over time have built systems. Again, we'll get into this as the interview goes, but systems to capitalize on those, to find those, even when they're real deals and when they're accidental deals as well, which I know that the stories of those have been publicized. But so let's talk about you personally here. You were an avid traveler, but not in the travel industry when your trip to Milan happened. It was just something you stumbled across. At the time, you were a journalist. When you go back even further back in time, you mentioned that being an entrepreneur is not something that really ever crossed your mind. And yet you're living a life now today where you've got, you know, 40 employees that are counting on your decisions and your direction. And there's all the management pieces that go into it and so forth. All the trappings of being a business owner. You were a journalist. Like, this was your passion. This was your career. This was your expertise. As you started to get more and more requests, or even your email list started to grow with the building of ScottsCheapFlights.com, ScottsCheapFlights.com. The wheels start to turn then that not only could this be a hobby that is fun, it's one that can pay. And then on top of that, now maybe it's one that can become your thing. Did you have these challenges you were dealing with where I enjoy the work I'm doing though? and if this takes on too big of a life, I'll have to set that aside. Walk me through that process of thinking through this being a side project and a hobby and something you've quote unquote freelanced in, and something that you started to embrace even just in your mind as a possible thing that you would be, you know, would become your career, would become your business.
Yeah. So one of the main themes that you'll pick up on as you kind of hear my backstory is just so much serendipity. And this is another instance where, look, I'd been working for years as a journalist. I love doing it. I still, you know, am very fond of the craft and the profession. But life had taken me to a point when kind of Scott's Cheap Flights started, where I'd been working full-time as a journalist, and then I decided I wanted to do something a bit different and ended up moving down to Mexico for a while, because probably I just wanted to be able to go on an adventure, learn Spanish, be able to travel more, help teach English, a number of these different things, and do that while I was young, before I had, you know, a family or a spouse or a mortgage or all these things that kind of prevent those types of youthful adventures from coming to fruition. And it was around this time that I ended up launching Scott's Cheap Flights into an actual kind of paid business. But it also meant that, look, I was freelancing at the time. I had like a steady enough stream of income, but it wasn't a like full-time position per se. And so I was hitting at that moment a bit of a fork in the road where I said, look, I can either go down one path where I am getting another full-time position and really kind of re-entering the workforce in journalism, or I can really try to see, will this silly little Cheap Flights email list become, will anything become of it? And one of the things that ended up actually pushing me towards path number two there was really unexpected. It was that my then girlfriend, now wife, and I had just moved to Denver, out to Colorado, and we really wanted to get a dog. We really wanted to get a puppy. And knowing that, like, look, they're always, you know, they need to be house trained, like need a lot of attention when they're young and everything. Like, okay, my wife has a full-time job. When she keep working, I can, you know, do this freelance thing, see if this email list will take off, but in doing so, be able to stay at home and help raise this puppy. And we just sort of sat down and go, all right, this makes sense. Let's try this out for, you know, 6-8 months, see what it works. At worst case, if it doesn't end up coming to much, then you can see about getting a full-time position then. So I was like an extremely fortunate position to have a significant other to help kind of support the household that way. And then just, you know, super, super lucky that this puppy ended up coming that kind of kept me at home and forced me to devote myself to the Cheap Flights email list, and then started becoming what it was. And so I look back very fondly at my time in journalism, and I think it taught me a lot of these sorts of skill set that has been useful in my new career. But I'm very glad to be able to work and travel as well. I don't view it as something that's like inherently worse off.
So that's tremendous. And I think it's amazing how many people I talk to where the story could have changed and gone in one of many directions. I don't think it's crossroads always where it's this way or that way. There's multiple options in life always. But how often the story pivoted on a moment that could have gone either way. It could have gone this way. You could have done this. You could have done this. And sometimes it's these small little moments of opportunity that good entrepreneurs seem to see and size up well, even if they don't sit down and strategically think through it. Maybe it's sometimes a quick decision, but they make the decision that ends up paying off in a tremendous way. Was the idea of going all in on this an easy one for you then, or was it painstaking? Because you portrayed it as though it was, oh, there were a lot of things that were in place, very logical, very easy. But was it a difficult thing emotionally?
I think what I, in looking back at it now with some distance, it was easy in the sense that I didn't have a ton to give up in that moment. So, you know, some people are aspiring entrepreneurs, but are aspiring founders, and they have a full-time position. And so to be able to really kind of devote themselves to one, to a side hustle or a new business or something, like, it's hard to do when you're also working, you know, 40 or 50 hours in an office. And so it, like, I was in a fortunate position that timing wise, I just didn't happen to have that at that moment. And so I did have the time and attention to be able to devote to this. What I, ended up doing as well, and that I really kind of recommend to other aspiring entrepreneurs, you know, there's a whole romanticization around the idea of just like going all in from the very get-go, you know, just to burn the boats, really prove your devotion, because, you know, look, you got to be totally committed. And that's like, I understand the mentality, and that's all on good, but at the same time, look, don't be Pollyannish about the fact that most startups don't end up succeeding. It's a brutal reality. And this is something I was like very, very cognizant of from the get-go, that like chances are this is not going to succeed. And so I really, that didn't mean that I didn't believe in it. I didn't want to work, you know, against those odds and everything. But it was also being cognizant of like, I could have emptied my bank account and, you know, like if I had a full-time job, quit it and do all this, that, and the other to try to prove that I really wanted it. But I don't think that's ends up being a very wise way for most people in most situations, because of the brutal realities of the marketplace, and that it's really difficult to find that sort of product market fit. So what I really try to recommend and impress to people it is actually not a bad thing to kind of like take it a little slow from the beginning, try to find that product market fit, slow walk it, and start to see, are people kind of like, are they buying what you're selling? You know, are you starting to get that traction? Are you starting to get that results in the marketplace before you sort of take that plunge into the deep end? And so for me, it took a solid 6 or 7 months after first launching Scotchy Flights as an actual paid business before I stopped, like I completely stopped doing journalism. I was juggling both at the time. You know, I was either Scotchy Flights was my full time and moonlighting as a journalist, or journalism was my full time as moonlighting as a cheap flight finder, however you want to view it. But I was juggling both for a number of months until it became like really apparent and really clear that, wow, this thing has legs. Like this thing could really go somewhere. I'm seeing the sorts of results. I'm seeing the sorts of pickup, and it was starting to make more money than my writing was. And so I started to be like, okay, now, you know, I've gotten enough signal here that I should actually go all in on this. But I think too many people want to skip that step and just jump right into the all in. You know, if you're lucky, if you're one of the small percentage that whose startup does succeed, great. You know, that then it looks like a genius move. But for most of us, and most businesses that don't end up succeeding, it's a pretty costly move to end up doing if you go all in like right from the get go.
Right. To me, back in 2013, staying back in that time frame, when you're launching this and you're building it as a newsletter that you've got people that are subscribed to maybe find these little hidden gems like this. Well, actually, let me phrase it as a question first. What did you require membership right out of the gates, or did you allow people to be a part of the email list and do it sort of literally as a generous offering to people? Help me understand how the monetization evolved, even in the earliest days, not where it's at today, where we know it's a membership, but in the beginning days, how did you sort through what people would have a stomach to pay for? Because they may not travel every single month, right? They may have this one trip that they need it for and may feel like it being a better suited as a blog with advertisers on it versus it being a membership option. How did you think through that in the earliest days?
Yeah. So what had happened was that the email list, which started in 2013 as just something for my friends, and you know, a few dozen my friends signed up, they really liked it. And you know, through the rest of 2013, 2014, early 2015, they were telling their friends, and the list had grown pretty substantially. And so by summer of 2015, it had reached about 5,000 people on the list. So all of a sudden, I was graduated out of the free tier of MailChimp. That was the email provider I was using at the time. And so I couldn't, you know, I could no longer send these emails for free. I had to pay to be able to do it. And as much as I enjoyed it as a hobby, being able to find these deals and send them out to friends, I felt kind of weird having to pay out of pocket in order to let other people know about these deals. So I started to think, okay, how could I just recoup my costs? Like, that was the goal. I still at the time wasn't thinking about turning it into an actual kind of bona fide business or thinking that it could take off the way it has. I was just trying to recoup the 50 bucks a month now that I think about it. And so I tossed around a couple different monetization ideas in my mind. First idea was ad supported, but you know, look, like nowadays, 5,000 people, it would take a long time to be able to get any sort of real traction from ad support and monetization. And it's a lot of like time selling or really low revenue, low quality ads as a result. I just didn't really like that sort of route. And so another option would have been taking commission. So, you know, if somebody books a deal that we send out, then we would get some portion of that. But the thing is, I didn't like that the way that that set up the incentives, because if you think back to thinking of why flights are so flummoxing to people, it's because they're confusing and that the price is always jumping around. People don't know when to book. And so I was asking people, hey, trust me that this is a good deal. Trust me that, you know, when I tell you that this, you know, you don't worry with those like $750 flights to Europe, hold out for the $350 flights to Europe. They're putting a lot of trust in me. And so I didn't like the idea of then turning around and having a profit incentive for them to be able to book, because I can, you know, I don't like the optics of asking them to trust me, but also getting sort of a payment under the table for them taking that action. So I decided, okay, I don't want to go commission. What's the third option? I decided, you know, I was looking at membership. Hey, are people willing to pay to receive this? Is this something that they value enough that they're willing to actually kind of explicitly put their money to? And so I essentially set this up as a hypothesis. I wanted to test, are people willing to pull out their credit cards and do this? And so I set up a super low price point because I didn't want it to be a question of like, is this worth, you know, $5 a month or whatever price. I just wanted it to be a black and white, you know, am I willing to pay a tiny price for this or not? So I set it at $2 a month because I figured like, look, what is $2? Like nobody's going to think about that and be like, oh, that's too rich for my blood. But at the same time, it's telling me, are people willing to get over that categorical shift? Are they willing to go from something that they could get for free to something that they're being asked to pay for? Because remember, coming from the journalism industry, I was incredibly familiar with, if you remember back in the 2000s and whatnot, most newspapers, most news sites would put out all their content for free on the website. And then they realized, you know, shoot, we're losing a ton of money doing this. Let's try to set up some paywalls, and seeing, you know, a huge backlash, because psychologically for people, when we take something that we had gotten for free and then are being asked to pay for it, we really rebel against that. And so I was very cognizant of that. So I really wanted to try to make sure that I could get, like, see if people were willing to jump over that hurdle with me. So I set it at $2 a month, and I set it up as a freemium model. So think of Spotify, where you have your free list and your premium list. Obviously, folks on the premium list get a bunch of extra perks. And I just started, because I didn't want to kick off everybody who didn't, you know, who wasn't willing to pull out their credit card. So that's what I did. Set it up as freemium list, $2 a month, and just see, hey, how many people can we get? Can we get the 25 people who would be needed to cover the $50 a month in hosting costs? And lo and behold, I got those 50 people, I think, in the first 3 or 4 days. Like, it was very, those 25 people, that $50. And then, you know, everything beyond that, I think at the end of the first month, there were 100 people. So, like, I had made $150 profit in the first month, which was like, whoa.
But wait a minute. That suggests to me that the first thing on your mind to move from this being something that's a free offering, it's an email that you're, that obviously it's grown to 5,000. So at that point, you're already seeing it, viewing it differently. It's a hobby plus, you know, but the fact that you're incurring costs with MailChimp and all that sort of thing, that, it's funny to me that the first thing that occurs to your mind is, okay, I got to cover my web hosting and my MailChimp costs. Like, as long as I can do that, I'm going to feel pretty good about things. You weren't thinking at that point, wow, 5,000 email subscribers, what could I do to get this to 50,000, to 500,000, to whatever it is. You're thinking, okay, I just want to cover these costs for now, which some other entrepreneurs would feel like you're not thinking big enough.
Yeah, this is the difference between a journalist approaching this problem and somebody with, like, a business background, an entrepreneur. And so, you know, I recognize that I probably was not the case study that they'll be teaching at in business schools for those situations.
Have you ever noticed that many of the problems people call in with on this show can be solved by hiring someone? Sometimes you need a full-fledged team, other times maybe just a simple assistant or an expert in something you're not great at. Whatever your reason for hiring, we recommend you take a look at LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. As you may know already, LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. And LinkedIn Jobs makes the process of finding the perfect teammate easy and intuitive. Hiring is always easy when you have access to so many quality candidates. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours when using LinkedIn Jobs. I've used it myself, and it was so simple. In fact, I've made multiple hires using LinkedIn Jobs. And did I mention, by the way, it's free to business owners like me and you. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/freelance. That's linkedin.com/freelance to post your job for free, or click the link in our show description. Terms and conditions apply. You know, working from home is mostly great, but there are some days when I realize I haven't left my house or even my chair, like, all day. Have you been there? Getting outside to exercise or making a trip to the gym are just harder now that my office is just a flight of stairs away. If you're stuck in the same rut as me, then you should try Hydro. That's Hydrow. With the Hydro Rower and 20 minutes a day, getting a full body workout is so much easier. Hydro can work up to 86% of your muscles in just 20 minutes for an insane effective home workout. That's because Hydro pairs the effectiveness of rowing with the power of technology to connect you with over 5,000 video trainings, classes, and workouts. And get ready to get out from behind your home desk, because after a few months of daily rowing with Hydro, your partner's going to want to take you out for a night on the town to show you off. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use code freelance to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydrow.com and promo code freelance to save $400. Hydro.com, promo code freelance, or just click the link in our show description.
However, there's something to be said for having an initial price point that is immediately a great test. That's low enough. That's a great test of whether people are willing to pay you, basically, almost like reward you for the value you've been providing them. It's so minimal. I mean, it's a half a coffee a day or something like that for one month, and they're paying you for that. But also, it's almost a, you can always go up. Like, it's tough to go backwards. You know, if you charge, you try to charge $99 a month, you would have had a mutiny on your hand or something like that. And people thought, geez, this guy's extremely greedy for what he's been delivering for me. But to start at two is almost like, hey, listen, I've been providing value to you. You know, let's throw a little something in here and we'll continue to produce great deals for you. And you can always bump from there. So I don't know if you saw it that way. Obviously not. You're worried about covering the hosting cost at the time. You get your people, your 100 or so people to cover those costs, 50 to 100 people to cover those costs. And did you start thinking like, oh boy, maybe I could have gone with $9.99 a month or $19.99 a month? Did you kick yourself at all during that process? Or you just go from there?
I didn't have time to. I didn't have time to kick myself. But at the same time, it wasn't so much like, I wasn't worried about optimizing revenue or optimizing profits early on. It was really just a matter of answering that test. Like, are there people who are willing to pull out their credit card? And what does this sort of like growth prospects look for this? I mean, think of it in a nutshell as, is there product market fit for this type of thing? Like, do people find value in it that they're willing to pay for? I think where it really started to click in my mind was, you know, that first month is just, hey, you know, on a lark, let's just see what happens. But then that second month, when, you know, 100 people sign up the first month and then 125 or 150 signed up the second month. So all of a sudden there are 250 people on the list by the end of month two. And I had, you know, $50 in expenses, but I got $500 in revenue. And I was like, whoa. And realizing, like, you know, this is not something that I'd sort of like projected forward, the beauty of subscription business, where it's just kind of like ongoing recurring revenue coming in rather than it sort of being like a sales business where there's big chunks or stuff like that. But it was very, really laid bare for me in that sort of second and third month and watching it kind of continue to grow and continue to multiply. And so it's at that point where I started to think like, okay, there is something here. People are valuing it. You know, this thing has got legs. What are the next steps then to take in order to optimize this thing?
When did you think that? How quick into that process did you start thinking that? Okay. I gotta do this. I gotta think through this now a little bit more strategically. Was that month two that soon, or did it take a few months?
Well, it's funny because between at the time, I was spending, you know, a few hours a day writing articles, doing journalism, spending at least a few hours a day hunting for like cheap flights, trying to hunt for deals to send out to the email list, spending a few hours a day responding to emails because, you know, especially it being an email native product, like if anybody has a question, they just hit reply. And so I'd have, you know, dozens of emails every day I'd need to get back to people. And I really kind of like took a lot of pride in wanting to get back to people immediately, like not wanting to let it sit for, you know, a day or two and not even a few hours. I was like, if they email me, I want to get back to them right away, especially given the real kind of time sensitive nature of flight deals. And then not to mention, you know, this puppy that I had at home. Plus, you know, look, I was 27, 28. Like, I'd like to have a little bit of a social life. I had then girlfriend at home, like there were a lot of things, kind of calls on my time. And so between everything, it was hard to sort of find the time and space to think sort of big picture strategically about the business or about the direction or those sorts of like strategic decisions. It was much more a question of just trying, you know, am I staying afloat here? Can I like trying to balance all the different calls for my time? And so it was around that sort of, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember, about 3 months in, maybe 3.5 months in, that I started to realize that, gosh, I need some help here. Like, I can't do this on my own. It's getting much bigger than I expected. I need to find somebody else to help out with this. And so it was around that time that I got an email request from a guy who was starting a travel blog. And he was like, hey, can I interview for this? I'll buy a couple subscriptions and give them away, you know, as part of a, like a promotion tactic. So I was like, great. You know, and we had a nice little interview for his blog, had this great chat. And after that, I went away from that conversation thinking like, okay, I really need a co-founder. I could spend the next 4, 5, 6 months like racking my brain, you know, trying to work my network, trying to think of anybody I can to potentially become a co-founder and come in on this together and really try to figure out who's the least risky option. Or I could maybe make the offer just to this guy I met on the internet a couple minutes ago. And so it ended up, of course, I ended up going with the second option, and which sounds completely insane now, you know, however many years later. But it was one, again, into that sort of theme of serendipity. We ended up just really jibing together well and having and like my gut intuition that, wow, this is a really sort of smart, forward-thinking, ambitious, and just really savvy guy whose skill set really mirrors my own. Like, he was really good in thinking about business strategy and development and marketing and all those types of things. And I was really good, you know, at writing and the flight deals and stuff like that. So it ended up, you know, made this offer. I said, yeah, let's do it. Let's go in on it together. And then that ended up sort of getting the wheels in motion where he was being able to think a little bit more kind of bigger picture strategically about where to take this thing while I was kind of still manning the ship and keeping those flight deals churning every day.
This is Brian.
Yeah, exactly. So this is my co-founder, Brian.
What's funny about this to me is it sounds like you knew you were facing a pinch on your time. Like there's only so many hours in the day. You've got the newsletter that needs to go out on a regular basis. You've got the deals. You need to stay on top of short-term deals that may only exist for a few hours. But you've also got inbound requests that are coming via email. Let alone, I don't know what kind of web presence we're talking about here that you had to maintain to feature any of these things, since it was largely email-based, I know. But how did you decide that Brian had all that you needed and you weren't still going to be missing important pieces of the puzzle because he's your first hire, right? He's not really a hire, he's a founder, but still you choose to bring him on board. How did you decide that you were going to be adequately covering the right bases by bringing him versus, oh, you know what, I need to bring somebody who can crawl some of these airline websites or something like that, like a technical founder. How'd you make that decision?
Let me tell you, Brandon, it was a total guess. I had no idea. But the thing was, the thing to remember here is twofold. One is that anytime you hire somebody, you never really know. You know, like all the entire hiring process is essentially an exercise in risk mitigation. You're trying to find who can I get enough of a sense of to project forward how they're going to be in this particular role or position. And who seems like, you know, that they have the lowest chance of blowing up in my face. And so look, I, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like it was the most thorough of searches. Like I really just kind of got a good feeling and went with it here. And this is not something that I would like advise new startup founders that they're like, oh yeah, follow my path and just whoever the first person to interview, make them an offer to become your co-founder. but
it sounds like you got in Brian's case, you got a sense for how he thinks. You got a sense for it's almost as though he was evaluating how the Scott's Cheap Flights entity could offer more, could be more. And you got a look at what his vision was without, and it was all accidental. You know, it wasn't like he was auditioning for the job, let alone auditioning for a role as a co-founder. But he was sort of demonstrating an aptitude that you didn't know, but clearly discovered you valued. Does that make sense?
That's right. Yeah. Not only did, you know, you get to see a sort of earnestness about somebody when they don't feel like they're on, when they're on the spot, you know, or they're being interviewed, but at the same time, you, like it wasn't as though, like, as soon as the interview cut off, I was like, Brian, come on board, be my co-founder. You know, like I sort of went back, thought about it, you know, we shot a few emails back and forth, like starting to think about, okay, what could this look like? You know, what ideas did he have? So like there was some measure of due diligence, but I think the larger point is to remember, like at this time there, you know, it sounds crazy in retrospect because now the company's 40 people on the team and, you know, a few million members and all that. But at the time, it was very low stakes. Like, I think there were 500 people who had signed up for the list. And so it was like, worst case, if this doesn't end up working out, then, you know, like, look, I lost a business that was making $1,000 a month.
And did you think about it that way too? Did you think about, like, not that you curtailed your vision, you weren't thinking, this thing's never going to have millions of members. I'm not suggesting that you were thinking that way, but you probably weren't consciously thinking about, is he the right guy for this business to be a $50 million business or something? You know, you weren't evaluating it in that way anyway.
That's correct. Like, it wasn't like, you know, when Uber has a CEO vacancy and they're sitting there trying to evaluate who's the right person to take the helm of this, you know, multi-billion dollar company. Like it was bringing in $1,000 a month. And so it wasn't nothing, but it wasn't like the biggest risk in the world. But at the same time, even if I didn't know it sort of consciously, I had a sense in my gut that like, there was something here, like this thing could definitely grow and get a lot bigger, but I'm not going to be able to do it on my own. Like I'm not, you know, I'm going to need some other people who are really kind of smart and cunning and shrewd, but also I also didn't have, you know, a ton of sort of people that came to mind, like, oh, you know, either Brian or this person, or Brian or this. It was mostly like evaluated against itself, and it was like, I know I could have gone back and done a many month search for this type of thing, but I'm not sure that it would have resulted in. I mean, it certainly wouldn't have resulted in a better outcome because, I mean, he's just been absolutely essential for the company, I'm not even sure that it would have been a better decision to go about that way because I for that type of company at that point, for the type of people I might be able to find, it's such a hard thing to find a co-founder in the
right
first place.
And you would have been looking and if you had gone about it overly formal where you're getting resumes and so forth, it seems like you would have had the infamous interview scenario, which is you across the table from people evaluating one another in a very formal way. And the way it actually rolled out with you and Brian was much more organic and natural and conversational. So you could get inside one another's heads and determine if there's a real chemistry there, as opposed to a chemistry that emerges in an interview, which is always hoped for, but maybe not always real. You know what I mean?
Well, especially because this type of role is not, you're not a mercenary, you know, you don't have like X, Y, and Z things that you need to accomplish and then, you know, the day's over. Like it's a very sort of a missionary role. You're really thinking about like, how can I grow this company? You know, you're living, eating, breathing it and knowing that like its success is dependent on my ability to think creatively and to execute. And for that reason, it's that much more difficult to be able to hire for in the first place. And this is why so many co-founders end up being, you know, either siblings or college roommates or college, you know, like people that you really know well and not like an open casting call for a co-founder.
Right. Where you do your best to vet the person and do your due diligence, but that's all the logical stuff you do to make sure boxes can be checked, as opposed to the, I don't want to say it's emotional, but as opposed to the rapport building that you see if, are we going to be able to work well together? Are we going to be able to bring out more in each other because of how we work together, as opposed to you have this acumen, you know, this, you have this, and this, and so forth. So I don't want to spend too much time about that. I just think it's interesting that That's how you learned you would best operate is by finding a founder accidentally in some ways at a time when you knew you needed one, but not necessarily on purpose, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Very fortunate.
So let's talk a little bit about those first decisions. You've now brought Brian on board. Talk about, and you don't have to talk in a month by month way, but the evolution of the company at that point. How did you decide how to structure and scale the company so that it could be a 1+1=3 or 4 or 5, to use that cliche, sadly, and the two of you would accomplish much more than just having a second person on board helping you out with a few tasks. What did you do to energize the company at that point?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because so many startups and so many companies operate with a very sort of long-term thinking projects in mind. You know, oh, we want to get to this goal or this metric in 3 years, and so we're going to work backwards from there. And for us, it the way we operated for years was really very reactive. And that sounds, you know, bad. It sounds like, oh, you know, there wasn't a lot of strategy. But at the same time, I think it was the right decision for where we were as a company, you know. And by reactive, I mean, hey, people were emailing us saying like, oh, Scott, I'm not getting my emails quickly enough, or they're going to spam, or how can I, you know, make sure I'm getting only deals out of my home airport rather than all the deals or stuff like that. And so each time we would sort of like be listening to users, we'd try to think, okay, what are the tools that we can build? And bear in mind, I don't have a computer programming background. Brian is much better at it than me, but he's not, you know, a developer by trade or anything. And so we're sort of trying to build these things. We're trying to like market the website a little bit. Oh, you know, trying to think all the little sort of things where in a larger company, you know, there's a marketing division and there's an engineering division.
Right.
There's a team, you know, internal tool. Yeah. Yeah, all these types of things. And we're just like wearing each one of these hats every single day, trying to be like, you know, and this is in addition to the very core product of Flight Deals and trying to build up the company. And so for a long time, it was very reactive. It was very, you know, what fire needs to be put out today, what's broken today. But through it all, through the sort of figuring that all out, the company's still growing. Like it's growing really, really quickly because people love cheap flights. And people hate going through the process of trying to find cheap flights on their own because it's a horrible process. Like booking airfare is such a horrible user experience that just having somebody there by your side to help you out and let you know when those deals pop up takes it from a horrible experience to an incredibly joyous one that people like to celebrate. And so, for instance, even the very act of asking people to, hey, when you book, you know, when you find a deal that we, you know, people would write back, oh, I got this deal. And then asking, hey, will you let your friends know? You know, we post about it on Facebook or Twitter or something, like being able, making that decision. Then all of a sudden, you know, all of their people know, and who doesn't, you know, cheap flights are such a broadly appealing thing that it wasn't like trying to sell, I don't know, you know, trying to sell some sort of random trinket that had a very narrow audience. Like everybody is the audience for cheap flights. And so trying to just get the word out there and trying to get people to recommend it to their friends was one of those early sorts of things we were really going for. Because, look, I come at this from somebody who is very skeptical. I mean, that's the journalist in me. It's just like so
too good to be true, right?
Everything. Yeah. And so, even to this day, we essentially have had a $0 paid marketing budget. Like we just haven't really done paid ads. And the reason why is because it's just very skeptical of like, anytime somebody tries to sell me something, I just really recoil at it. I'm like, you know, I'm like not interested. And it's just sort of like a gut instinctual reaction. I think there are a lot of people with that same sort of mindset as me. But on the flip side, if I have a friend or somebody that I know well who says like, oh, Scott, you know, did you hear about this cool new service that you know, you can just download an app and then you can ride a car, you know, you can call a car and they'll pick you up anywhere and take you anywhere, I'm like, Oh, cool. That sounds great. I'll check that out. Like, I'm very, not only is my guard not up, but I'm like, I'm in, I'm bought in. If it comes recommended to me, then yeah, absolutely. And so that was really trying to capitalize on that was one of our early sorts of, I think, lucky initiatives, because that's.
And that's the question. That's where I wanted to go next, actually, is there's two pieces of the puzzle here. There's the, how do you grow rapidly without relying on advertising? And I want to find out more about this word of mouth that you're building, that you're sort of stoking, the fire you're stoking on that. And then there's also the part of finding the best deals. There's the human and or algorithmically driven element to that as well. So in the, when you got to the point where it's at a pain point for you to do this all by yourself, that is try to encourage people to keep subscribing their friends or recommending, the site to friends or the service, the email service to friends, as well as finding the deals. How did you start to scale some of those things so that you could always feel like you're providing the best value to people, but you're not ignoring the fact that you need to grow as well, right? How were you doing that, and how did that evolve when Brian came aboard?
Yeah, so one of the lucky things about the business and just the way that it's set up in the first place is that it's kind of inherently scalable. You know, whether once I find a really good flight deal, emailing it out to the list is the same amount of effort whether there's 50 people on it or 50,000. You know, it just like there's an essential, the marginal cost of any additional user, at least the marginal expense for the business, is essentially nothing. So in that sense, it's like really fortunate to be inherently scalable and, you know, not one of those companies like, you know, like an Uber, like some of the like food delivery ones where the more they grow, the more money they lose. And, you know, they're just trying to compete for market share. And so, what it became, I think, a question of early on is when do we hire certain people for certain roles, and where should Brian and I's effort be directed towards? Like, when does a problem become big enough that we should handle it by bringing somebody else on board to deal with it?
Dedicated to that, solving that problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. So like the very, very first hire that we made was somebody to come in and be a customer support expert. You know, someone to be a customer advocate, because we were spending, you know, hours and hours every day trying to respond to people who are writing in like, oh, you know, hey, Scott, I just booked this deal. Thanks so much. Or, hey, Scott, you know, I want to get this deal, but I'm having trouble finding on it. Can you help me? All the, you know, at that point, probably hundreds of emails a day that we're getting in there was taking a ton of time to be able to manage. And that was taking away from time being able to spend thinking about the business, thinking about, you know, new initiatives, looking for deals, all these other types of other things. And so, you know, we'd bring on somebody there and then we'd say, oh, shoot, you know, our tech stack is starting to, there was no tech stack at the time, but like, you know, whatever, like our website's starting to break because we would have some very popular initiative and 20,000 people would all log on to the website at the same time and it would just crash. Like it would just go down. So we were like, God, we need an engineer here. Like we need somebody who actually knows how to do this stuff. And so, you know, we would hire somebody there and then we would be like, oh man, we're getting way more emails than we expected. Maybe we should hire a couple more customer service advocates. And so, again, going back to sort of being a little bit reactive, it was looking at sort of every step of the road. Were we starting to bring like is our time better spent tackling that problem ourselves or bring people on to handle it? And even something like we were getting a lot of requests. Scott, I love this idea. Can you do the same thing but for Australia, you know, or for New Zealand or for Canada or for the UK? And partly because of geographical, you know, the middle of Australia day is when I am fast asleep and vice versa. And partly because, frankly, I don't actually know that much about like Australia flight deals. Like I could rattle off just about everything about like US and Canada flight deals, but for Australia, not exactly up my alley. So I was like, okay, why don't we see about bringing on an Australia flight expert? And why don't we see about bringing on a UK and Europe flight expert? So you can see how each kind of, it was definitely like a one step of the, at a time, but also partly because remember, we were and we are a completely bootstrapped company. Like we didn't take any VC funding. We didn't take any outside investment. And part of the reason for that is we wanted to make sure we could maintain that control and not have to be answering to investors. But it also meant that we had to kind of be very mindful of the budget, be mindful of the revenue. I mean, we're profitable from day one, but we wouldn't have been profitable. We wouldn't have had much room to do that if we had hired, you know, 10 people in the first 6 months or something like that. So it was a slow but intentional growth.
To that point, as the company has grown and you've added people, and this was your first company. This was your first, you made the point at the very beginning how many first time businesses just don't work out, you know, for a variety of reasons. In your case, it has worked out. But what are the lessons that you've seen in this endeavor? You've probably gotten sucked into more the entrepreneurial world, business building world, and spent less time in the journalist world. And as you interact with more aspiring founders or actual founders, what is the wisdom that you feel like you've gained that you wish along these lines of growth and being reactive? Like you're saying it in some ways like it's a negative thing, but clearly it's been wise for you guys to work that way. How has that played into, excuse me, and what's the wisdom you would pass on to another aspiring founder in that way?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned and the biggest mistake that I see a lot of people making is being way too theoretical and not ever testing and being way too late to like test things out or see if it works in practice. So for example, we never wrote a business plan. Like we never did one of those big long documents. Oh, here's where we're going to be in, you know, 1 year and 3 years and 5 years. And I think most people who do write a business plan will tell you that like by day two, it's essentially outdated. Like it's completely obsolete. And it's not that it's a horrible exercise to go through and it's never valuable, because I think it can sort of like focus the mind a bit. But I think that there's a temptation for a lot of people starting up a business to want to figure out all the answers ahead of time and have everything like completely lined up and completely ready to go and as though they have, you know, complete control over what the outcome is going to be. And they're not realizing that they're doing this at the expense of execution and at the expense of moving quickly. You know, I can't remember who said it, but somebody, Steve Jobs or somebody along those lines said something to the effect of, you know, if you wait till something is 90% ready, you've waited too long. Or maybe it's like if you wait till it's completely ready, you've waited too long. And so I think one of the virtues that Scott's Chief Flight had from the beginning was just being right into the marketplace, you know, right in seeing, hey, are people willing to pay for this? Having a real kind of, it was the first emails and the first website and everything. It was rough. Like it was really rough. But that's okay. Like it's that, you know, you can, what you gain by being at rough is you don't have to spend tens of thousands of dollars on a really spiffy website. And you don't have to spend tens of thousands on, you know, personnel and engineers and marketing and all this. And you just get to see, you know, you could spend all this money on these other things, but if you're not able to convince customers to pay for whatever it is you're selling, then it's all going to be for naught. And so, you know, that seems like pretty important to be able to see that early on. Are people willing to pay for this thing? And that's like, it can feel like an obvious answer in retrospect, and you know, because you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But at the time, you know, any new business, and especially one that in a way, in a sort of industry or in a model that hasn't really existed before, like Scott's Cheap Flights, it doesn't it's not obvious at the time that people will pay for it. And there are plenty of what seemed like, you know, slam dunk businesses that did not end up getting people, you know, convinced to pay for it. You know, I've dozens and dozens of friends from college who started up businesses and it sounded great. I was surprised that not many people were willing to pay for it. But again, goes back to remembering that 90-something% of startups fail. And so being, you know, not having that hubris that, oh yeah, people are going to love this, but instead going in early, testing it out, making it very kind of like low, a low lift build, and then, and seeing and making it more of a cycle, I think ends up benefiting people a lot more than trying to figure out everything from the get-go and spend a ton of money doing it.
Right. Well, the development world would use the term like sprints, doing things in short terms where it's bite-sized, it's manageable. You have a short-term finish line and you can see, does the marketplace like this? Okay.
Yes. Sprints and MVPs,
right.
Minimum viable product.
Yep.
See, just put it out there. It doesn't have to be spiffy. See if people like it. And if they do, then you can make it spiffy. It doesn't have to stay like that forever.
Yep. All right, so I have one more question for you, and then we'll get into the final segment that I warned you about. My final question for you is the future. It is no hidden secret that people love cheap flight deals. So there's no shortage of people always trying to find new ways to shake up the market with you know, this deals site or whatever it is. And it's not just for travel. It's for a lot of different industries as well. As more people try to either algorithmically or in a curated way build alternatives, as you look ahead to the next 24 months or so, and I know you're not the type that's going to say, this is what we're going to do, and this is what we're going to do, how do you envision how your company will need to evolve in terms of how you engage members so that you can continue to be on the forefront of, not just from a growth standpoint, but delivering exactly what they hope for when they sign up for premium membership?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, our biggest competition is apathy. It's just people not knowing that this exists, because every time, you know, I mean, when people sign up, they love it. And I don't say that as an egotistical thing. I don't say that to like toot my own horn. I say that as somebody who loves to travel and hates spending money to do it. And I was even surprised how, like, it feels so intuitive. Of course, why wouldn't people love cheap flights? But I don't think I even realized the extent to which it is such a popular thing and such a hated thing to be alone trying to find good flight deals on your own. And so the question in my mind is like, how can we provide a service that is both providing that value, hooking people up with cheap flights, but also being able to do it in as personalized way as possible. Because, you know, if I'm in Seattle, like a cheap flight out of Miami is, that's great. It doesn't hurt me, but it doesn't do much for me, you know? Or if I just went to South Korea, like if I get home from that, you know, getting a notification about a deal to South Korea, doesn't do much for me. Like I want to go somewhere else. You know, I just went there. Or maybe I'm a teacher and I'm like, I can only travel in the summer. Like it could be the best mistake fair in the world, but if it's, you know, during the school year, not much I can do. And so really trying to build out our systems and trying to build out our offerings so that we can make the Scotch Cheap Flights experience as personalized as possible, because we each have our different, we all love cheap flights, but we each have our different sort of preferences within that cheap,
right? Budget. Tolerances, like there's certain things we'll tolerate, whether it's location or other encumbrances with a trip.
You know, some people travel just because they like whatever it is. I just need to get to a beach. You know, I need a daiquiri in my hand and the waves in the background. Some people are like, I want to go mountain. You know, I want to go mountain trekking wherever it is. Some people, I want to go explore the city. Like we each have our different preferences, but we want to make sure that we're not paying more for flights than we had to. Something that you said earlier really kind of resonated with me, that there's something so uniquely, it's either uniquely human or frankly uniquely American, of the fear that somebody out there got a really good deal and it's not me, you know, that it, like being, you're locked in this flying metal tube for however many hours and just sitting there wondering like, did the person next to me pay more or less than me for this flight? And you know, like I Gosh, it pains me if I could know that the person next to me got a better deal.
Yeah, you don't want to feel like the sucker. No one wants to be the sucker.
Nobody wants to feel like the sucker. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for the time today. It's been interesting to not only get an idea of how the company has grown through the years, but anybody can see that from the outside. It's been more interesting to figure out how you chose to make the decision and bring in Brian on board and how things have evolved since then. But just even how you think about evaluating the business and make decisions in a proactive or reactive way, I think that's been really valuable. And I appreciate the time today. But I don't let you go until you get to participate in my final segment. So I warned you about the 3-for-1 segment. One principle, one habit, and one person. So let's dig into our final segment here, and then I'll let you run with that. So our 3 questions in order are: one principle or value that you believe — this is the hook I didn't tell you — that you believe that most people don't believe.
Ooh, one that I believe that most people don't believe. So you really caught me with the the one that most people don't believe here, because I feel like that's the cost of what seems like time old wisdom, is that it just gets repeated over and over again. People tend to believe on it. You know what? One of the things that I believe that most people don't, is being just how cognizant of how terrible predictors we are of our own career paths. Like, we're told in, college, like, oh, you've got to pick the right major so that you will get a good job after. And, oh, you've got to, get a great job after, so it sets you up for future great jobs and whatnot. And look, the fact is that most people, like, they've done studies on this, most people change career, not just jobs, but change careers 3 times over the course of their career. Like, total, look at me. I was a journalist first, and now I'm cheap flights expert. Who knows what I'm going to be next? You look at Michael Lewis was the famous author of Moneyball and The Big Short and others. He studied art history in college. Julia Child, the famous chef, I think she studied English. So I think there's a bit of humility in predicting your own career path, but in also embracing the opportunities as they come is warranted. But I think we're sort of led to believe that we are in complete control, and that we control our own career paths. And that's true. I mean, there, to a certain extent, yes, but at the same time, is there any way that I ever could have predicted in college, or even like 6 or 7 years ago when this first started, that I'd be where I am today? No way in hell. Absolutely not.
And I think it's ironic. I told you these would be quick hitting, but I apologize for adding to this. But isn't it ironic how much pressure universities seem to put on people to choose their degree earlier in their college life now, when it matters less, you would argue, in their actual career? Maybe a conversation for another day, but I find that ironic. All right, question number 2. Question 2: one behavior or habit that you try to stick to no matter what. It's one of the most important habits to you.
Yeah. I try to go to the gym, and I shouldn't say I try. I do go to the gym quite regularly. And one of the decisions I sort of made early on, and I'm not sure, I'm not a trainer. I'm not a licensed physical therapist. So take my advice with a grain of salt. But what has worked for me is the notion, is really when it clicked in my head that it was about quantity over quality. So much of our life, and in most areas of life, it's not bad advice to say like quality is more important than quantity. And I think that's a very sort of faddish way of looking at most things, that you really want to prioritize quality. But if you take somebody who goes to the gym twice a month for 3 hours at a time, and then you take somebody else who goes to the gym 3 times a week for 20 or 30 minutes each time, that person who goes for, you know, three times a week for 20 or 30 minutes, like they probably go the same amount in a full month, but because they're doing it consistently in quantity, they're going to be in way better shape and they're going to have a far better, like, functioning body, functioning mind, all those types of things than if they were really trying to, you know, kind of be like binge in their exercise. And so I really have sort of aimed for a personal approach where I basically years ago found the bare minimum amount of time that I could spend at the gym that I would be able to consistently go three times a week. That, you know, if that meant only going for 10 minutes, go for 10 minutes, like what is the bare minimum amount of time that I can spend at the gym where I won't be tempted to skip the next time? And knowing that I can always ratchet that up later, but getting in the habit of going consistently. And now going to the gym for me is basically like brushing my teeth. You know, it's not something that I'm like, oh, do I want to or not want to? It's like, it's on the schedule. I'm going. Yeah, exactly. But I'm not, you know, when I'm not going for an hour. I'm not going for an hour and a half. Like I've found a sort of like good kind of consistent regimen that I know I can stick to without being tempted to skip. And so I know that's really worked for me of finding even at a minimum amount of time, finding a routine that I'm not tempted to skip because I knew prizing quantity over quality was going to be a better payout in the end.
Good. All right. And your final one. One person you most admire or very much admire that you take your cues from in life, or maybe you most aspire to be like?
So, gosh, I'm deciding between two tough ones in my head, but I think I'm going to go with Damian Lillard. Famous Portland Blazers basketball player. A lot of people remember him for that incredible shot he had to knock out the Oklahoma City Thunder in last year's NBA playoffs. An incredible basketball player, really nice guy. What was really kind of remarkable to me about him? You know, he's a NBA star, you know, an all-star, has like a max contract, you know, really just an incredible player, but who you know, was not highly recruited out of high school, not highly recruited out of college. I think he was a mid-round draft pick. And so not just that he has, you know, risen up, like there are plenty of players who have risen up to fame from more modest beginnings, but the mentality that he brings to the team is something really fascinating to me in that he gets interviewed and he's asked like, oh, you know, why don't you take an offer to go play, you know, in LA or go play in New York or Chicago or something like that. And the way that he answers this is something really remarkable. He says, look, I could do that, but at the same time, I know that if I were to accept a different deal, a deal at another team just to be able to get more money, then that kind of creates a sort of butterfly effect around the not only the two teams that are trading, but frankly around the league, where there are, you know, dozens of people who end up getting traded as a result. Each of those dozens of people, they're not just NBA players, they have families. And each of them all of a sudden has to uproot their lives, move somewhere completely new, you know, their kids have to, all this type of thing, just because I wanted an extra, you know, $5 million off of, in addition to the 140 or whatever million. And so he's basically said, you know, like, look, I'm like, want to stay here and do right by my team and making those decisions in a really eyes open, selfless, sort of aware of everybody else was just like a really heartwarming and remarkable thing to me, especially that you don't see too often, especially in that level of professional sports. So that's something that has been on my mind some recently, and really really look up to and admire that type of mentality to a team.
That's a good one. Scott, thank you so much. I appreciate the time today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me here. This was great.
All right. That was Scott Keys and his story, founder of scottscheapflights.com. Stay tuned for next week, as we bring you the story of Stephanie Harder, founder and author of Eating Like You Give a. If you enjoyed this episode, give us your rating or review on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you enjoy your podcasts. And tell a friend or two or three, won't you? Recommend us, mention us, pass us along, and reach out to me again on Twitter at Brandon Hull. Finally, thank you to my co-producer, Preston Lee, founder of Millo and admin of the Millo Mastermind community on Facebook, as well as our incredible production assistant, Bilal Abrar, and to our friends at the Podglomerate Network.
The Podglomerate, a sonic universe.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next week on Freelance to Founder.